much. But I've got to go. Can't explain. Lyra.
2 minutes later she was walking along the riverbank again, and looking only at the path ahead of her, and with the hood of her parka pulled up over her head. If she saw anyone, she'd have to take no notice. People often carried their demons, if they were small enough, in a pocket or buttoned inside their coats. She might be doing that. There was no need for anyone to suspect her if she walked on quickly, and it was still early. But the journey to Botley, where Dick lived with his family, still took most of an hour, even walking fast, and she heard the bells of the city across the expanse of Port Meadow striking unhelpfully. What? 7:30? 8:30? Surely not yet. She wondered what time his night shift finished. If he started work at 10, then he should be coming out sometime soon. She slowed down as she came to Binsey Lane. It was going to be a rare, clear day. The sun was bright now, and the air was fresh. Binsey Lane led down from the meadow into the Botley Road, the main route into Oxford from the west. And people would be getting up now, and going to work. She hoped they'd be too busy to look at her, and had their own worries and preoccupations. She hoped that she looked uninteresting, as Will made himself look, as the witches did when they made themselves invisible, so that no one would give them more than a glance and then forget them at once. She might be a witch herself, with her demon hundreds of miles away on the tundra. That thought sustained her until she reached the Botley Road, where she had to look up to check the traffic before she could cross, and to look for the right little street going off the other side. She'd been to the Orchard's house 3 or 4 times. She remembered the front door, even if she'd forgotten the number. She knocked. Dick should be home by now, surely? But what if he wasn't? And she had to explain herself to his mother or his father, who were nice enough, but... She almost turned and walked away, but then the door opened, and it was Dick.
Lyra, what are you doing here? You all right?
He looked tired, as if he'd just come home from work.
Dick, are you on your own? Is there anyone else in?
What's the matter? What's happened?
No, it's only me and my gran. Come in.
Hang on. His vixen demon was backing away behind his legs, and uttering a little cry. He picked her up, and then he saw what the matter was.
Where's Pan? Lyra, what's going on?
I'm in trouble, she said, and she couldn't hold her voice steady.
Please, can I come in?
Yeah, sure, of course you can.
He moved back to make room in the little hall, and she stepped inside quickly and shut the door behind her. She could see all kinds of consternation and anxiety in his eyes, but he hadn't flinched for a moment.
He's gone, Dick. He's just left me,
she said. He put a finger to his lips and looked upstairs. Come in the kitchen, he said quietly. Gran's awake, and she's easily frightened. She can't make sense of things. He looked at her again as if he were unsure who she was, and then led the way along the narrow corridor to the kitchen, which was warm and rich with the smell of fried bacon. She said,
I'm sorry, Dick. I need some help. And I thought...
Sit down. You want some coffee?
Yes, thanks.
He filled a kettle and set it on the range. Lyra sat in the wooden armchair on one side of the fire, holding her rucksack tight against her chest. Dick sat in the other. His demon, Bindi, leaped up to his lap and sat close, trembling.
I'm sorry, Bindi, Lyra said. I'm sorry. I don't know why he went, or I mean I do, but it's hard to explain. We always wondered if you could do this, said Dick.
What do you mean?
Separate. We never seen you do it, but it just felt like if anyone could do it, you could. When did he go?
In the night.
What, no message or nothing? Not exactly. We'd been arguing. It was difficult.
You didn't want to wait in case he came back?
He won't come back for a long time. Maybe never.
Oh, you don't know?
I think I gotta go and look for him, Dick.
A thin cry came from upstairs. Dick looked at the door.
Better go and see what she wants, he said. Won't be a minute.
Bindi was out of the door before he was. Lyra sat still and closed her eyes, trying to breathe calmly. When he came back, the kettle was boiling. A spoonful of coffee essence in each mug, a splash of milk, the offer of sugar, and he poured some water into 2 mugs and handed one to Lyra.
Thanks. Is your gran all right?
She said. Just old and confused. She can't sleep easy, so there's got to be someone here with her in case she gets up and does herself some damage.
You know the grandfather you mentioned the other night at the White Horse? Is she his wife?
No, this one's Dad's mother. Egyptians are on Mum's side of the family.
And you said he was in Oxford now? Yeah, he is. He had a delivery to the Castle Mill boatyard, but he's off soon. Why? Could he... Do you think I could meet him?
Yeah, if you want to.
I'll go there with you when Mum gets back.
His mother worked as a cleaner in Worcester College, Lyra remembered.
When would that be?
She said. About 11, but she might be a bit later, do a bit of shopping or something.
Why do you want to meet my granddad?
I need to go to the Fens. There's someone I have to see there. I need to ask the best way of getting there without being seen or caught or... I just want to ask his advice.
He nodded. He didn't look very Egyptian himself at the moment. His hair was disheveled, his eyes red-rimmed with tiredness. He sipped his coffee.
I don't want to get you into trouble either, she added. Is this something to do with what you told me the other night? Someone being killed near the river?
Probably, but I can't see the connection yet.
Benny Morris is still away from work, by the way.
Oh, the man with the wounded leg? You haven't told anyone about what I said.
Oh, yeah, I put a great big notice up on the bloody canteen wall. What do you take me for? I wouldn't give you away, gal.
No, I know that.
But this is serious stuff, right?
Yes, it is.
Anyone else know about it?
Yeah, a man called Dr. Polstead, Malcolm Polstead. He's a scholar at Durham College, and he used to teach me a long time ago. But he knows about it all because, it's complicated, Dick. But I trust him. He knows things that no one else... I can't tell him about Pan leaving, though. I just can't. Pan and me, we'd been quarrelling. Oh, it was horrible. We just couldn't agree about important things. It was like being split in half. And then this murder happened, and suddenly I was in danger. I think someone knows I saw it. I stayed at Dr. Polstead's parents' pub for a couple of nights. But which pub's that? The Trout at Godstow? Do they know Pan's... disappeared? No. I left before anyone got up this morning. I really need to get to the Fens, Dick. Can I see your granddad? Please?
There was another cry from upstairs, and a thump, as if something heavy had fallen on the floor. Dick shook his head and hurried out. Lyra was too restless to sit still. She got up and looked out of the kitchen window at the neat little yard with its cobblestones and bed of herbs, and at the calendar on the kitchen wall with a picture of Buckingham Palace and the changing of the guard, and at the frying pan on the draining board with the bacon fat already beginning to congeal. She felt like crying, but took 3 deep breaths and blinked hard. The door opened, and Dick came back.
"Oh, she's woken up proper now, damn it," he said. "I'll have to take her some porridge. Sure you can't stay here for a while? They'll never know. No, I've really got to keep moving."
"Well, take this, then." He held out his blue and white spotted neckerchief, or one very similar, tied in a complicated knot.
"Thanks. But why?"
"The knot. It's an Egyptian thing. It means you're asking for help. Show it to my granddad. His boat's called the Maid of Portugal. He's a big, tough man. Good-looking. Like me. You won't miss him. He's called Giorgio Brabant."
"All right. And thanks, Dick. Hope your gran gets better."
"Nah, there's only one way that'll end. Poor old girl." Lyra kissed him. She felt very fond of him.
"See you when I get back," she said.
"How long are you going to stay in the Fens?"
"As long as I need to, I hope."
"And what was that name again? Doctor or something?"
"Malcolm Polstead."
"Oh, yeah." He came to the door with her.
"If you go up Binsey Lane, past the last house, there's a path through some trees on the right that takes you to the river. Cross the old wooden bridge and keep going a little way and you come to the canal. Go left up the towpath and that'll get you to Castle Mill. Good luck. Just keep bundled up. Then maybe they'll think he's... you know."
He gave her a kiss and embraced her briefly before seeing her out of the door. Lyra saw the compassion in Bindi's eyes and wished that she could stroke the pretty little vixen, just for the sake of touching a demon again. But that was impossible. Lyra could hear the old woman calling in a quavering voice from upstairs. Dick shut the door, and Lyra was out in the open again. Back up to the Botley Road, still busy with traffic, and then Lyra went across and set off for the river. She kept her hood up and her head down, and before long she came to the path through the trees and the old wooden bridge that Dick had mentioned. To left and right, the slow river extended, upstream through Port Meadow and downstream towards the Oxpens and the murder spot. There was no one in sight. Lyra crossed the bridge and continued on the muddy path between water meadows, and came to the canal, where a line of boats was moored, some with smoke coming out of their tin chimneys, one with a dog that barked furiously until she came closer, when it must have sensed something wrong. It turned and skulked down to the other end of the boat, whining. A little further along, Lyra saw a woman pegging out some washing on a line strung the length of her boat, and she said,
"Good morning, lady. I'm looking for Giorgio Brabant of the Maid of Portugal. Do you know where he might have moored?"
The woman turned to her, half suspicious of any stranger, and half mollified by Lyra's correct use of the term of respect for Egyptian stranger.
"He's further up," she said, "at the boatyard. But he's moving on today. You may have missed him."
"Thanks," said Lyra, and walked on fast before the woman noticed anything wrong. The boatyard extended along an open space on the other side of the canal, under the campanile of the oratory of St. Barnabas. It was a busy place. There was a chandlery, where Malcolm had gone 20 years before to look for some red paint. There were workshops of different kinds, a dry dock, a forge, and various pieces of heavy machinery. Egyptians and landlopers were working side by side, repairing a hull or repainting a roof or fitting a tiller, and the longest of the boats tied up, and by some way the most richly decorated, was the Maid of Portugal. Lyra crossed the little iron bridge and walked along the quay till she came to the boat. A large man with sleeves rolled up over his tattooed arms was kneeling in his cockpit, reaching down into the engine with a spanner. He didn't look up when Lyra stopped beside the boat, but his black and silver caissant demon, ruffed like a lion, stood up and growled. Lyra approached the boat, steady, quiet, watchful.
"Good morning, Master Brabant," she said.
The man looked up, and Lyra saw Dick's features, larger, older, coarser and stronger, but unmistakably Dick. He said nothing, but scowled and narrowed his eyes. Lyra took the neckerchief out of her pocket and held it carefully in both hands, opening them to display the knot. He looked at it, and his expression changed from suspicious to angry. A dull red suffused his face.
"Where'd you get that?" he said.
"Your grandson Dick gave it me about 30 minutes ago. I went to see him because I'm in trouble, and I need help."
"Put it away and come aboard. Don't look around. Just step over the side and go below."
He wiped his hands on an oily rag. When she was inside the saloon, he came through to join her and shut the door behind him.
"How'd you know Dick?" he said.
"We're just friends."
"And did he put this trouble in your belly?"
For a moment, Lyra didn't know what he meant. Then she blushed.
"No, no, it's not that kind of trouble. I take better care of myself than that. It's that my demon..."
She couldn't finish the sentence. She felt horribly vulnerable, as if her affliction had suddenly become gross and visible. She shrugged and opened her parka and spread out her hands. Brabant looked at her from head to foot, and his face lost all its color. He took a step backwards and clutched the doorframe.
"You ain't a witch," he said.
"No, just human, that's all."
"Dear God. And what's happened to you?" he said.
"My demon's lost. I think he's left me."
"What do you think I can do about it?"
"I don't know, Master Brabant, but what I want to do is get to the Fens without being caught and see an old friend of mine. He's called Coram Van Texel."
"Father Coram? And he's a friend of yourn?"
"I went to the Arctic with him, and Lord Fa, about 10 years ago. Father Coram was with me when we met Yorick Burneson, the King of the Bears."
"And what's your name?"
"Lyra Silvertongue. Well, that's the name the bear gave me. I was called Lyra Balakwa till then."
"Well, why didn't you say so?"
"I just did."
For a moment she thought he was going to slap her for being insolent, but then his expression cleared as the blood came back to his cheeks. Brabant was a good-looking man, just as his grandson had said, but he was perturbed now, and even a little frightened.
"This trouble of yours," he said. "When did it come on you?"
"Just this morning. He was with me last night, but we had a terrible quarrel, and when I woke up he was gone. I didn't know what to do. Then I remembered the Egyptians, and the Fens, and Father Coram, and I thought he wouldn't judge me badly, he'd understand, and he might be able to help me."
"We still talk about that voyage to the north," he said.
Lord Farr's dead and gone now, but that was a great campaign, no doubt about it. Far de Coram don't move much from his boat these days, but he's bright and cheerful enough.
I'm glad of that. I might be bringing him trouble, though.
Ah, he won't worry about that. But you weren't going to travel like this, were you? How do you expect to go anywhere without a demon?
I know. It'll be difficult. I can't stay where I am, where I was staying, because... Well, I'll bring trouble on them. There's too many people coming and going there all the time. I couldn't hide for long, and it wouldn't be fair to them, because I think I'm in danger from the CCD as well. It was just luck I heard from Dick that you were in Oxford, and I thought maybe... I don't know. I just don't know where else to go.
No, I can see that. Well...
He looked out through the window at the busy waterfront, and then down at his big caissant demon, who returned his gaze calmly.
Well, Brabant said, John Farr come back from that voyage with some Egyptian children what we'd never seen again else. We owe you that. And our people made some good friends among the witches, and that was something new. And I got no work on for a couple of weeks. Trade ain't good at the moment. You been on an Egyptian boat before? You must have been.
I sailed to the Fens with Mar Coster and her family.
Mar Coster, eh? Well, she wouldn't stand no nonsense. Can you cook and keep a place clean?
Yes.
Then welcome aboard, Lyra. I'm on me own at the moment, since me last girlfriend took a run ashore and never come back. Ah, don't worry. I ain't looking for a replacement. In any case, you're too young for me. I like my women with a bit of mileage on them. But if you cook and clean and do my washing, keep out of sight of any landlopers, I'll help you in your trouble and take you to the Fens. How's that?
He held out his oily hand, and she shook it without hesitation.
It's a bargain, she said.
At the very moment when Lyra was shaking the hand of Giorgio Brabant, Marcel Delamere was in his office at La Maison Juste, touching a little bottle with the point of a pencil, pushing it sideways, turning it around. The weather was clear, and the sunlight fell across his mahogany desk and sparkled on the little bottle, which was no longer than his little finger, capped with a cork and sealed with a reddish wax that had dripped halfway down the side. He picked it up and held it to the light. His visitor waited quietly, a man of Tartar appearance, but in shabby European clothes, his face gaunt and sunburnt.
"And this is it? The famous oil?" said Delamere.
"So I was told, sir. All I can do is tell you what the merchant said to me."
"Did he approach you? How did he know you were interested?"
"I had gone to Akshi to look for it. I asked among the merchants, the camel dealers, the traders. Finally, a man came to my table, and..."
"Your table?"
"Trade is done in the tea houses. One takes a table and makes it known that one is ready to trade silk, opium, tea, whatever one has. I had assumed the character of a medical man. Several dealers came to me with this herb, that extract, oil of this, fruit of that, seeds of the other. Some I bought to maintain my character. I have all the receipts."
"How do you know this is what you wanted? It could be anything."
"With respect, Monsieur Delamere, it is the rose oil from Caramacan. I am happy to wait for my payment until you have tested it."
"Oh, we shall. We shall certainly test it. But what was it that convinced you?"
The visitor sat back on his chair with an air of weary but well-guarded patience. His demon, a serpent of a sandy grey colour with a pattern of red diamonds along her sides, flowed over his hands, in and out, through and through his fingers. Delamere caught an air of agitation, strongly subdued.
"I tested it myself," said the visitor. "As the dealer instructed, I put the smallest possible drop on the end of my little finger and touched it to my eyeball. Oh, the pain was instant and shocking, which was the reason the dealer had insisted we leave the tea house and go to the hotel where I was staying. I had to cry out with the shock and the pain. I wanted to wash my eye clear at once, but the dealer advised me to remain still and leave it alone. Washing would only spread the pain further. This is what the shamans do, those who use the oil, apparently. After, I suppose, 10 or 15 minutes, the worst of it began to subside, and then I began to see the effects described in the poem of Jahan and Roxana."
Delamere had been writing down the visitor's words as he spoke. Now he stopped and held up his hand.
"What poem is this?"
the poem called Jahan and Roxana. It relates the adventure of two lovers who seek a garden where roses grow. When the two lovers enter the rose garden after all their trials, guided by the king of the birds, they are blessed with a number of visions that unfold like the petals of a rose and reveal truth after truth. For nearly 1,000 years, this poem has been revered in those regions of Central Asia.
Is there a translation into any of the European languages?
I believe there is one in French, but it is not thought to be very accurate.
Delamere made a note. And what did you see under the influence of this oil? He said.
I saw the appearance of a nimbus or halo around the dealer, consisting of sparkling granules of light, each smaller than a grain of flour. And between him and his demon, who was a sparrow, there was a constant stream of such grains of light back and forth in both directions. As I watched, I became convinced that I was seeing something profound and true, which I would never afterwards be able to deny. Little by little that vision faded, and I was sure the rose oil was genuine, so I paid the dealer and made my way here. I have his bill of sale.
Leave it on the desk. Have you spoken to anyone else about this?
No, monsieur.
Just as well for you. The town where you bought the oil. Show it to me on this map. Delamere stood to fetch a folded map from the table and spread it open in front of the traveller. It showed a region about 400 kilometres square, with mountains to the south and north. The visitor put on a pair of ancient wire-rimmed spectacles before staring at the map. He touched it at a point near the western edge. Delamere looked, and then turned his attention to the eastern side, scanning up and down.
The desert of Karamakan is just a little further to the southeast than this map shows, said the traveller.
How far from the town you mentioned, from Akçe?
500 kilometres, more or less.
So the rose oil is traded that far west?
I have made it known what I wanted, and I was prepared to wait, said the traveller, taking off his glasses. The dealer had come to find me especially. He could have sold it at once to the medical company, but he was an honest man.
Medical company? Which one?
There are 3 or 4 of them. Western companies. They are prepared to pay a great deal, but I managed to acquire this sample. The bill of sale.
You shall have your money. A few more questions first. Who sealed this bottle with wax?
I did.
And it has been in your possession all the way?
Every step.
And does it have a lifetime, so to speak, this oil? Does its virtue fade?
I don't know.
Who buys it? Who are the customers of this dealer?
He doesn't only sell oil, monsieur. Other products also, but ordinary ones, you understand. Herbs for healing, spices for cooking, that sort of thing. Anyone would buy those. This special oil is used mainly by shamans, I believe. But there is a scientific establishment at Tashkulak, which is...
Glasses on. He peered at the map again.
Like the desert, just off this map. He has sold oil to the scientists there a small number of times. They were very keen to obtain it, and they paid promptly, though they did not pay as much as the medical companies. I should say there was such a place, until recently.
Delamere sat up, but not sharply. There was, he said. Go on.
It was the dealer who alerted me to this. He told me that when he last travelled to the research station, he found the people there in a state of great fear, because they had been threatened with destruction if they did not stop their researches. They were packing up, making preparations to leave. But between leaving Akçe and arriving here, I have heard that the establishment has been destroyed. All those who were still there, whether scientific staff or local workers, have either fled or been put to death.
When did you hear this?
Not long ago, but news travels quickly along the road.
And who was it who destroyed the place?
Men from the mountains. That is all I know.
Which mountains?
Well, there are mountains to the north, to the west, and to the south. To the east, only desert, the worst in the world. The mountain passes are safe, or used to be, because the roads are well trod. Maybe not so anymore. All mountains are dangerous. Who knows what sort of men live there? The mountains are the dwelling place of spirits, of monsters. Any human beings who live among them will be fierce and cruel. Then there are the birds, the Ogabgorgs. There are stories told about these birds which would terrify any traveler.
I am interested in the men. What do people say about them? Are they organized? Have they a leader? Do we know why they destroyed the station at Tashbulak?
I understand it was because they believed the work there was blasphemous.
Then what is their religion? What counts as blasphemy for them?
The merchant shook his head and spread his hands. Delamere slowly nodded and tapped his pencil on a small pile of folded and stained papers.
These are the expenses you incurred, he said.
They are. And of course the invoice for the oil. I would be grateful.
You should be paid tomorrow. Are you staying at the Hotel Rembrandt, as I recommended?
I am.
Stay there. A messenger will bring you your money before very long. I would remind you of the contract we signed so many months ago.
Ah, said the traveller.
Yes, ah, indeed. If I learn that you've been talking about this business, I shall invoke the confidentiality clause and pursue you through every court till I have recovered all the money you're being paid, and a great deal more besides.
I remember that clause.
Then we need say no more. Good morning to you. The visitor bowed and left. Delamere put the bottle of oil into a desk drawer and locked it, then turned over in his mind the news the merchant had told him. But there was something about the way the man had looked at him while talking about it, something surprised, maybe skeptical, maybe doubtful. It had been hard to read. In fact, Delamere knew quite a lot already about these men from the mountains, and his purpose in asking about them was to find out how much was known by others. No matter. He wrote a swift note to the rector of the College of Theophysical Research, and then brought his attention back to the project that was occupying most of his time. A forthcoming congress of the entire magisterium, of a kind that had never happened before. The oil, and what had happened at Tashbulak, would be at the centre of their deliberations, though very few delegates would know that. Malcolm was detained most of that day by college business, but as the afternoon clouded over, he locked his door and set off for Godstow. He was keen to tell Lyra about the meeting at the Botanic Garden, and everything he'd learned from it, and not just to warn her. He wanted to see her expression as she absorbed all the implications of what had happened. Her emotions came and went so vividly that it seemed to him that she was more in tune with the world than anyone else he'd known. He didn't know quite what he meant by that, and he wouldn't have said it to anyone, least of all her, but it was enchanting to see. The temperature was falling, and there even seemed like a hint of snow in the air. When he opened the kitchen door at the Trout and went in, the familiar warmth and steam enveloped him like a welcome. But his mother's face, as she looked up from the pastry she was rolling, was tense and anxious. "You seen her?" she said at once. "Seen Lyra? What do you mean?" She nodded towards the note Lyra had left, which was still in the middle of the table. He snatched it up and read it quickly, then again slowly. "Nothing else," he said.
"Well, she left some of her things upstairs. Looks like she took what she could carry. She must have gone out early, before anyone else got up."
"Did she say anything yesterday?"
"She just looked preoccupied. Unhappy, your dad thinks. But she was trying to be cheerful, you could see that. She didn't say anything much, though, and she went to bed early."
"When did she go?"
"She left before we got up. That note was on the table. I thought she might have come to you at Durham, or Alice, maybe."
Malcolm ran upstairs and into the bedroom Lyra had been using. Her books, or some of them, were still on the little table. The bed was made. There were a few items of clothing in one of the drawers. Nothing else.
"Fuck," he said.
"I wonder," said Asta from the windowsill.
"What?"
"I just wonder if she and Pantalaimon both went, or if she thought he'd gone and went after him. We know they weren't very happy together. But where would he have gone? Just to go out on his own? We know he used to do that. That's when I saw him first. But..."
He was baffled, and angry, and far more upset than he could remember being for a long time.
though she'd always know that he'd come back, Asta said. Perhaps this time he just didn't.
Alice, he said at once, we'll go there now. Alice was drinking a glass of wine in the steward's parlour after dinner.
Good evening, Dr. Polstead, said the steward, rising to his feet. Will you take a glass of port with us?
Another time with pleasure, Mr. Corson, Malcolm said, but this is rather urgent. May I have a quick word with Mrs. Lonsdale? Alice, seeing his expression, stood up at once. They went out into the quad and spoke quietly under the light by the hall steps.
What's the matter? She said.
He explained briefly and showed her the note.
What does she take with her?
Her rucksacks and clothes. Not a clue otherwise.
Had she come to see you in the last day or so?
No, I wish she had. I'd have made her tell me the truth about her and that demon. Yes, I saw there was something wrong, but it wasn't something I could bring up in conversation with urgent things to talk about.
You knew they weren't happy then?
Not happy. They couldn't stand each other, and it was awful to see.
How'd she get on at the Shroud?
They saw the state of mind she was in, but she didn't say anything about it.
Alice, you did know she and Pantalaimon could separate.
Alice's demon Ben growled and pressed himself against her legs.
She never spoke about it, said Alice, but I thought there was something different about them after they come back from the north. She was like someone haunted, I used to think. Shadowed kind of thing.
Why'd you mention it now? Just a feeling the Pan might have left, and she went off to try and find him.
She must have thought he'd gone a long way. If he was just out for a scamper in the woods, he'd have been back before morning.
And that's what I thought. But if you hear from her, or hear anything about her,
of course.
Is there anyone else in the college she might have spoken to?
No,
she said decisively. Not after the new master as good as chucked her out, the bastard.
Thanks, Alice. Don't stand about in the cold.
I'll tell old Ronnie Corson that she's missing. He's fond of her. All the servants are. Well, the original servants. Hammond's got some new buggers that don't talk to anyone.
Oh, this place ain't the same as it used to be, Mal.
A quick embrace, and he left. 10 minutes later, he was knocking on Hannah Ralph's door.
Malcolm, come in.
What's... Lyra's vanished, he said, shutting the door behind him. She was gone before Mum and Dad were up this morning. Must have been pretty early. She left this note, and no one's got a clue where she's gone. I've just been to ask Alice, but...
Pour us some sherry and sit down. Did she take the alethiometer with her?
It wasn't in her bedroom, so I suppose she must have done.
She might have left it there if she was intending to come back, if she thought it would be safe.
I think she felt safe there. I was going to talk to her this evening, tell her about the business at the Botanic Garden.
Oh, I haven't even told you yet, have I?
Does that concern Lyra? Yes, it does. He told her about the meeting, and what he'd learned from it, and the men from the CCD.
Right, she said. Definitely Oakley Street business. Are you seeing her again?
Lucy Arnold, yes, and the others. But Hannah, I was going to ask, would you be able to look for Lyra with your alethiometer?
Yes, of course I could, but not quickly. She might be anywhere by now. What is it, 12 hours or so ago when she left?
I'll gladly start looking, but it'll only give me a general idea at first. It might be easier to ask why she's gone, rather than where. Do that, then. Anything that'll help.
The police? What about telling them she's missing?
No, he said. Less attention they pay to her, the better.
Yes, I think you're probably right. Malcolm, are you in love with her? The question took him utterly by surprise.
What on earth? Where did that come from? He said.
The way you talk about her.
He felt his cheeks flaring. Is it that obvious? He said.
Only to me.
There's nothing I can do about it. Nothing at all. Completely forbidden by every kind of moral and...
Once, yes, but not anymore. You're both adults. All I was going to say was, don't let it affect your judgment.
He could see that already she regretted having asked about it. He'd known Hannah for most of his life, and he trusted her completely. But as for a final piece of advice, he thought it was the least wise thing he'd ever heard her say. I'll try not to, he said. Chapter 12 The Dead Moon. Lyra soon fell into a comfortable enough way of life with Giorgio Brabant. He wasn't over-scrupulous as far as cleaning was concerned. She gathered that his last girlfriend had been a zealot for scrubbing and polishing, and that he was glad to live a little more casually. Lyra swept the floors and kept the galley sparkling, and that satisfied him. Where cooking was concerned, she had learned a few things in the Jordan kitchens, and she could make the sort of hefty pies and stews that Brabant liked best. He had no taste for delicate sauces or fancy desserts.
"What we'll do if anyone asks who you are," he said, "is we'll say you're my son Alberto's gal. He married a landloper woman, and they live down Cornwall way. He hadn't been on the water for years. You can be called Annie. That'll do. Annie Brabant. Good Egyptian name. As for the demon, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it."
He gave Lyra the forward cabin, a cold little place until he put a rock oil stove in there. Wrapped up in bed at night, with a naphtha lamp beside her, she pored over the alethiometer. She didn't try the new method. She felt uneasy about it. Instead, she gazed at the dial and let her mind hover, not setting off onto a wild sea so much as drifting over a calm one. She kept herself as free from conscious intention as she could manage, asking nothing and puzzling over nothing, and floated in her mind over the sun or the moon or the bull, looking down on each one, taking in all their details with equal attention, gazing into the great depth of the symbol ranges, from the highest levels that were so familiar now to the lower ones fading into darkness further down. She hovered over the walled garden for a long time, letting all the associations and connotations of nature and order and innocence and protection and fertility and many, many other meanings float past like exquisite jellyfish, their myriad tendrils of gold or coral or silver drifting in a pellucid ocean. From time to time she felt a little snag at the drift of her awareness, and knew that the young man she'd mistaken for Will was looking for her. She made herself relax, not fight it, not even ignore it, just float. And presently the snag disappeared, like a little thorn that catches for a moment on a traveller's sleeve, only to pull out when the traveller walks on. She thought constantly about Pantelimon. Was he safe? Where could he be going? What did he mean by that brief and contemptuous note? Surely he couldn't have meant it literally. It was cruel. He was cruel, and she was cruel too, and it was all a mess, all a dreadful mess. She hardly thought of Oxford at all. She wondered about writing a note and posting it to Hannah, but that wouldn't be easy. Brabant seldom stopped during the day, and tended to moor at night on a lonely stretch of water far from any village where there might be a post office. He was curious about why the CCD were interested in her, but when she kept saying she had no idea, he realized he wasn't going to get an answer, and stopped asking. He had things to tell her about the Egyptians and the fens, though, and on the third night of their journey, when the frost was hardening the grass on the riverbank, and the old stove was glowing in the galley, he sat down and talked with Lyra as she made their supper.
"The CCD, they got a down on the Egyptians," he told her, "but they doesn't do much to make us angry. Whenever they tried to enter the fens, we made damn sure they got lured into swamps and dead waterways where they'd never get out. There was one time when they tried to invade the fens in force. Hundreds of them. Guns and cannons and all. Seems the will of the Wixes, the jack-o'-lanterns, you heard of them? They shine lights out on the bogs to lure innocent people off the safe paths. Anyways, they heard the CCD was coming, and all the will of the Wixes come shining their lanterns and flickering this side and that, and the CCD men were so bewithered and bewildered that half of them drowned, and the other half went mad with fear. That was nigh on 50 years ago."
Lyra wasn't sure that the CCD had existed 50 years before. But she didn't quibble. "So the ghosts and the spirits are on your side, then?" she said.
"Against the CCD, they're on the Egyptian side, aye. Mind you, they chose the wrong time of the month, them CCD men. They come in the dark of the moon. Oh, it's well known that when the moon's dark, all the bogles and boggarts come out, all the ghouls and the bloody boneses, and they do powerful harm to honest men and women, Egyptian and landloper alike. They caught her once, you know. Caught her and killed her."
"Caught who?"
"The moon."
"Who did?"
"The bogles did. Some say they climbed up and pulled her down. Only there ain't nothing in the fens high enough for that. And others say she fell in love with Egyptian man and come down to sleep with him. And still others say she come down of her own accord, because she'd heard terrible tales of the things the Bogles got up to when she was dark. Anyway, she come down one night and walked about among the swamps and the bogs, and a whole host of wicked creatures, ghasts, hobgoblins, boggarts, hellwains, yethhounds, trolls, nixies, ghouls, fire drakes, oh, they come a-tippy-toeing after her, right into the darkest and dowlest part of the fens, what's known as Mirkmire. And there she turned her foot on a stone, and a bramble snagged her cloak, and the creeping horrors attacked her. The Lady Moon, they bore her down in the cold water and the filthy grim old bog where there's crawling creatures so dark and horrible they ain't even got names. There she lay, cold and stark, with her poor little old light just going out bit by bit. Well, by soon after, there come along Egyptian man, and he'd wandered off his path by reason of the dark, and he was beginning to be fearful on account of the slimy hands he could feel a-gripping his ankles, and the cold claws that scratched at his legs, and he couldn't see a bloody thing. Then, all of a sudden, he did see something. A little dim light a-shining under the water it was, a-gleaming, just like the mild silver of the moon. And he must have called out, because that was the dying moon herself. And she heard him, and she sat up just for a moment, like, and she shined all around. And all the ghouls and boggarts and goblins, they fled away. And the Egyptian man could see the path clear as day. And he found his way out of Mirkmire, and back home safe. But by that time, the moon's light was all gone. And the creatures of the night placed a big stone over where she lay. And things got worse and worse for the Egyptians. The creeping horrors came out the murk and snatched away babies and children. The jack-o'-lanterns and the will-o'-the-wixes shone their glimmers over all the bogs and the marshes and the quicksands. And things too horrible to mention. Dead men and ghouls and raw-heads and bonelesses, oh, they come creeping round houses at night and swarmed over boats, fingering at the windows, snarling the rudders with weed, pressing their eyes against the slightest little bit of light shining between the curtains. So the people went to a wise woman and asked what they should do. And she said, "Find the moon, and there'll be an end of the trouble." And then the man who'd been lost, he suddenly remembered what had happened to him, and he said, "I know where the moon is. She's buried in Mirkmire." So, off they set with lanterns and torches and burning brands, all pack of men, carrying spades and pickaxes and mattocks to dig up the moon. They asked that wise woman how to find her if her light had all gone out, and she said, "Look for a big coffin made of stone with a candle on top of it." And she made them put a stone in their mouths, each one of them, to remind them not to say a word. Well, they traipsed on, deep into Mirkmire, and they felt slimy hands trying to grasp their feet, and scary whispers and sighings in their ears, but then they come to where that old stone was lying, with a candle glimmering made of dead man's fat. And they heaved up the stone lid, and there was the dead moon lying there, with her strange, beautiful lady's face cold, and her eyes closed. And then she opened her eyes, and out there shone a clear silver light. And she lay there for a minute, just looking at this circle of Egyptian men with their spades and mattocks, all silent because of the stones in their mouths. And then she says, "Well, boys, it's time I woke up, and I thank ye all for finding me." And all around there come a thousand little sucky sounds as the horrors fled back down under the bog. Next thing, the moon was shining down from the sky, and the path was as clear as day. So that's the kind of place that's ours, and that's why you better have Egyptian friends if you come in the fens. You come in without permission, the bogles and ghouls will have you. You don't look like you believe a word of this.
I do, Lyra protested. It's only too likely.
She didn't believe it at all, of course. But if it comforted people to believe that sort of nonsense, she thought it was polite to let them do so, even if the author of the Hypercharasmians would have snarled with scorn.
"Young people don't believe in the secret commonwealth," Brabant said,
It's all chemistry and measuring things as far as they're concerned. Oh, they got an explanation for everything, and they're all wrong.
What's the secret Commonwealth?
The world of the fairies and the ghosts and the jack-o'-lanterns.
Well, I've never seen a jack-o'-lantern, but I've seen three ghosts, and I was suckled by a fairy.
You was what?
I was suckled by a fairy. It happened in the Great Flood 20 years ago.
You ain't old enough to remember that.
No, I don't remember it at all, but that's what I was told by someone who was there. She was a fairy out of the River Thames. She wanted to keep me, only they tricked her, and she had to let me go.
The River Thames, eh? What was her name, then?
Lyra tried to remember what Malcolm had told her. Diania, she said.
That's right! Damn me, that's right! That's her name! Well, that ain't common knowledge. You'd only know that if it was true, and it is.
I'll tell you something else, she said. Ma Costa told me this. She said I had witch oil in my soul. When I was a little kid, I wanted to be Egyptian, so I tried to talk an Egyptian way. And Ma Costa laughed at me and said I'd never be Egyptian because I was a fire person and I had witch oil in my soul.
Well, if she said that, it must be right. I wouldn't argue with Ma Costa. What are you cooking there?
Stewed eels. They're probably ready now.
Dish up, then,
he said, and poured some beer for them both. As they ate, she said, Master Brabant, do you know the word actorake? He shook his head.
It ain't an Egyptian word, and that's a fact, he said. Might be French. Sounds a bit French.
And did you ever hear of a place somewhere called the Blue Hotel? Something to do with demons.
Yeah, I did hear about that, he said. That's in the Levant somewhere, that is. It ain't a hotel of any kind, really. 1,000 years ago, maybe more, it was a great city. Temples, palaces, bazaars, parks, fountains, all sorts of beautiful things. Then one day the Huns swept down out the steppes, that's the endless grasslands they have further north, what seemed to go on forever. And they slaughtered all the people in that city, every man, woman and child. Oh, it was empty for centuries, because people said it was haunted, and I ain't surprised. No one would go there for love nor money. Then one day, there was a traveller, he might have been Egyptian man, who went there exploring, and he come back with a strange tale, how the place was haunted, all right, but not by ghosts, by demons. Maybe the demons of dead people go there. Maybe that's it. I don't know why they call it the Blue Hotel. Must be a reason, though.
Would that be a secret Commonwealth thing?
Ah, bound to be.
And so they passed the time, as the Maid of Portugal sailed nearer and nearer to the Fens. In Geneva, Olivier Bonneville was becoming frustrated. The new method of reading the alethiometer was refusing to disclose anything at all about Lyra. It hadn't at first. He'd spied on her more than once. But now, it was as if some connection was broken, a wire come loose. He was beginning to discover more about the new method, though. For example, it only worked in the present tense, so to speak. It could reveal events, but not their causes or consequences. The classical method gave a fuller perspective, but at the cost of time and laborious research, and it required a kind of interpretation that Bonneville had little patience for. However, his employer, Marcel Delamere, was directing all his attention to the forthcoming Congress of all the constituent bodies that made up the Magisterium. Since it was Delamere himself whose idea this was, and since he had no intention of making its true purpose clear, but every intention of arranging for it to deliver the resolutions he wanted, and since that involved a great deal of complex politics, Bonneville found himself comparatively unsupervised for a while. So he decided to try another approach to the new method. He had a photogram of Lyra, which Delamere had given him. It showed her among a group of other young women in academic dress, obviously on some university occasion. They stood formally facing the camera in bright sunlight. Bonneville had cut out the face and figure of Lyra and thrown the rest of the picture away. There was no reason to keep it, because the girls in it were too English to be attractive. He thought that if he looked at Lyra's face in the picture, a lithiometer in hand, it might help him focus more clearly on the question of where she was. So, having swallowed some pills to protect against travel sickness, in case the nausea struck again, he sat in his little apartment as the evening lights came on in the city, turned all three wheels to the image of the owl, and focused his attention on the scrap of photo paper with the picture of Lyra. But that didn't work either, or not as he'd hoped it would. In fact, it generated a blizzard of other images, each of them pin-sharp for a moment, and then succumbing to vagueness and blur, but each of them resembling Lyra for the second or so he could see them clearly. Bonneville narrowed his eyes, and tried to keep the pictures in focus for a little longer against the inevitable vertigo. They seemed to have the quality of photograms, all monochrome, some faded or creased, some on photographic paper, some on newsprint, some well-lit and professionally taken, others informal, as if taken by someone who wasn't used to a camera, with Lyra screwing up her eyes in the glare of the sun. Several of them seemed to have been taken surreptitiously when she was unaware, showing her lost in thought in a cafe, or laughing as she walked hand in hand with a boy, or looking around to cross the road. They showed Lyra at various periods in her childhood as well as more recently, her demon always in view. In the later pictures, his form was clearly that of some large rodent. And that was all Bonneville could tell. Then, with a lurch, he seemed to fall into an understanding of what he was looking at. They were photograms. They were pinned to a board. He could see a cloth folded back at the top of it, so they were probably kept under cover. Gradually, some details of the background emerged. The board was leaning against a wall, papered in a faint floral pattern. It stood next to a window across which a curtain of lustrous green silk had been drawn. It was lit by a single ambaric lamp on a desktop below. But whose eyes was he looking through? He had the impression of a consciousness, but something was moving. A hand moved and made Bonneville lurch again and almost vomit as the viewpoint swung around instantaneously and showed him a white form sweeping across in a blur of wings that set some of the pictures stirring on the board. Just a swift dash, a bird, a white owl, just for a moment, and it was gone again. Delamere. The owl was Delamere's demon. The hand was Delamere's. The floral wallpaper, the green silk curtain, the board of pictures was in Delamere's apartment. And although Bonneville couldn't see Lyra herself for some reason, he could see pictures of her, because it wasn't her he was focusing his mind on, but a picture of her. All this came to him in a second, as he sank back into his armchair, closed his eyes, and breathed deeply to settle the nausea. So, Marcel Delamere had collected dozens, scores of pictures of Lyra. He'd never mentioned them. And no one knew. He'd thought that his employer's interest in the girl was professional, so to speak, or political, or something. But this was personal. This was bizarre. It was obsessive. Well, that was worth knowing. Next question. Why? Bonneville knew very little about his employer, mainly because he wasn't interested. Perhaps it was time to find things out. The new method would be little use for that. And besides, Bonneville's nauseous headache made him reluctant to think of using the alethiometer again for a while. He'd have to go and ask people. Be a detective. With no clue about where Lyra might have gone, Malcolm and Asta went over and over his conversation with her at La Luna Caprese in Little Clarendon Street. "Benny Morris," said Asta. "That name came up at some point."
"Yes, so it did. Something to do with
someone who worked at the mail depot?"
"That's it. The man who was injured."
"We could try the compensation stunt," she said. So, after some work with Oxford City directories and voting registers, they found an address in Pike Street, in the district of St. Ebbs, in the shadow of the gasworks. In the character of a personnel manager from the Royal Mail, Malcolm knocked on the door of a terraced house the next afternoon. He waited, and no one answered. He listened, but heard only the clanking sound of railway trucks being shunted into a siding on the other side of the gasworks. He knocked again, Still, there was no response from inside. The trucks had begun to empty their coal one by one into the chute below the railway line. Malcolm waited till the whole train had gone through, and the series of distant thunders was replaced by the hollow clank of shunting again. He knocked a third time, and then heard a heavy, limping step inside, and the door opened. The man standing there was thick-set and bleary-eyed, and a strong smell of drink hung around him. His demon, a mongrel with mastiff in her, stood behind his legs and barked twice.
"Mr. Morris," said Malcolm, smiling.
"Who wants me?"
"Your name is Morris, Benny Morris."
"What if it is?"
"Well, I've come from the personnel department of the Royal Mail."
"I can't work. I got a certificate from the doctor. Look at the state of me."
"We're not disputing your injury, Mr. Morris, not at all. It's a matter of sorting out the compensation you're due." There was a pause.
"Compensation?"
"That's right. All our employees are entitled to injury insurance. Part of your wages goes towards it. All we have to do is fill in a form. May I come in?"
Morris stood aside, and Malcolm stepped into the narrow hall and shut the door behind him. Boiled cabbage, sweat, and pungent smoke leaf joined the smell of drink.
"May we sit down?" said Malcolm. "I need to get out some papers."
Morris opened a door into a cold and dusty parlour. He struck a match and lit the gas mantle on a wall bracket. A yellowish light seeped out of it, but didn't have the energy to go far. He pulled out a chair from under a flimsy table and sat down, taking care to demonstrate the pain and difficulty the process caused him. Malcolm sat on the chair opposite, took some papers from his briefcase, and uncapped a fountain pen.
"Now, if we could just be precise about the nature of your injury," he said cheerfully. "How did it happen?"
"Oh, yeah. Well, I was doing some work outside in the yard, clearing a gutter, and the ladder slipped."
"You hadn't braced it?"
Oh, yeah. I always brace a ladder. It's common sense, isn't it?"
"But it still slipped?"
"Yeah, it was a wet day. That's why I was clearing the gutter, like, because there was all moss and dirt in it, and the water couldn't flow proper. It was all gushing down outside the kitchen window."
Malcolm wrote something down. "Did you have anyone helping you?"
No, just me."
"Ah, you see," said Malcolm in a concerned tone, "for full compensation to be paid, we need to be sure that the client, that's you, took every sensible precaution against accident. And when working with ladders, that normally involves having another person to hold the ladder."
"Oh, yeah, well, there was Jimmy, my mate Jimmy Turner. He was with me. He must have gone inside for a second."
"I see," said Malcolm, writing. "Could you let me know Mr. Turner's address?"
Yeah, sure. He lives in Norfolk Street, number... Can't remember his number."
"Norfolk Street? Oh, well, that'll do. We'll find him. Was it Mr. Turner who went for help when you fell?"
Yeah. This compensation, how much is it likely to be?"
"It partly depends on the nature of the injury, which we'll go into in a minute, and on how long you're likely to be away from work."
"Right, yeah."
Morris's demon was sitting as close as she could get to his chair. Asta was watching her, and already the dog was beginning to twitch and look away. The faint beginning of a growl came from her throat, and Morris's hand reached down automatically to grasp her ears.
"How long has the doctor recommended you to stay off work?" Malcolm said.
"Oh, 2 weeks about. Depends. It might heal quicker. It might not."
"Of course. And now the injury itself. What damage did you actually do?"
"Damage?"
"To yourself."
Oh, right. Well, I thought at first I broke my leg, but the doctor said it was a sprain."
"Which part of your leg?"
The knee. Me left knee."
"A sprained knee?"
"Why, I sort of twisted it as I fell."
I see. Did the doctor examine you properly?
Yeah. My mate Jimmy helped me inside, right? And then he went to fetch the doctor.
And the doctor examined the injury?
That's what he did, yeah.
And said it was a sprain?
Yeah.
Well, you see, this is a little confusing for me, because the information I have is that you were rather badly cut. Asta saw the man's hand tighten on the ears of his demon.
Cut, said Morris. Yeah, I was, yeah.
It was a cut as well as a sprain?
Well, there was glass around. I repaired a window the week before, and there must have been some broken glass. Where did you get this information from, anyway?
A friend of yours. He said you were rather badly cut behind the knee. Now, I can't quite picture how you came to be cut there, you see.
Who was this friend? What's his name?
Malcolm had an acquaintance in the City of Oxford Police, a friend from his boyhood, a docile and affectionate child then, and a man of honest decency now. Malcolm had asked him, without saying why, if he knew of a constable at the police station in St. Aldate's who had a heavy, thick voice and a Liverpool accent. Malcolm's friend knew the man at once, and his expression told Malcolm what he thought of him. He gave Malcolm the name. George Paston, said Malcolm. Morris's demon uttered a sudden yelp and stood up. Asta was already on her feet, tail slowly swinging from side to side. Malcolm himself sat quite still, but he knew where everything was, and how heavy the table was likely to be, and which leg of Morris's was injured, and he was balanced partly on the chair, but partly on his feet, ready to spring. Very quietly, as if from an immense distance, and only for a moment or two, both Malcolm and Asta heard the sound of a pack of dogs barking. Morris's face, until then heavily flushed, went white.
No, he said. Wait a minute. George... I don't know anyone called George Paston. Who's he?
Morris might already have lashed out, except that Malcolm's calm and concerned expression had him utterly confused.
But he says he knows you well, Malcolm said. As a matter of fact, he says he was with you when you got that injury. He wasn't. I told you it was Jimmy Turner who was with me.
George Paston? Nah, I never heard of him. I don't know what you're talking about. Well, he came to us, you see, Malcolm said, watching carefully without seeming to.
And he was anxious to let us know that your injury was genuine, so that you wouldn't suffer any loss of earnings.
He said it was quite a bad cut. A knife was involved. But oddly enough, he didn't mention anything about a ladder, or about a sprain.
Who are you? Morris demanded.
Well, let me give you my card, said Malcolm, and took from his breast pocket a card that named him as Arthur Donaldson, insurance assessor, Royal Mail. Morris peered at it, frowning, and put it on the table.
What'd he say, then, this George Paston?
He said you'd suffered an injury, and your absence from work had a good reason for it. Your situation was genuine, and as he was a police officer, naturally, we believed him.
A police? No, I don't know him at all. He must have got me confused.
His account was very detailed. He said he helped you away from the place where the injury happened and brought you home.
But it was here. I fell off a bloody ladder.
What were you wearing at the time?
What's that got to do with what I normally wear? The trousers you're wearing now, for instance. No, I had to throw them away.
Because they were covered in blood?
No, you're getting me confused now. It wasn't like that. There was me here, and Jimmy Turner, and no one else.
What about the third man?
There wasn't anyone else.
But Mr. Paston is very clear about it. There was no ladder in his account. He said you and he had stopped for a chat, and you were attacked by a third man who cut your leg badly. Morris wiped his face with both hands.
Look, he said, I didn't ask for no compensation. I can do without it. This is all mixed up, this Paston. He's got me confused with someone else. I don't know nothing about what he's saying. It's all lies.
Well, I expect the court will sort it out,
What court? The Criminal Injuries Board. Now, all we need now is your signature on this form, and we can go ahead.
It's all right, forget it. I don't want no compensation now. Not if it comes with all these stupid questions. I never asked for this.
No, you didn't. I agree, said Malcolm, in his most bland and soothing way. But I'm afraid that once the process has started, we can't go back and undo it. Let's just get this business of the third man out of the way, the man with the knife. Did you know him? There wasn't no third man. Sergeant Paston says you were both surprised when he fought back. He ain't a sergeant, he's a con- Morris fell silent.
I've got you, said Malcolm. A slow, dark red flush moved up from Morris's neck to his cheeks. His fists were clenched, pressing down so hard on the table that his arms were trembling. His demon was growling more loudly than ever, but Asta could see that she'd never attack. She was mortally afraid.
You ain't, Morris croaked. You ain't nothing to do.